Welcome to Holden Village. Today is the 17th of August, 1995. It's Thursday. In the fireside room this afternoon, our speaker is Jeff Dwyer, and he will be speaking on aging, health, and social justice. So let's listen in on Jeff.
What I'd like to do today is begin to expand a little more on some of the general issues that we raised on Tuesday in terms of the growth of the elderly population and what that might mean. We talked a little bit about the economic costs associated with the growing elderly population in terms of long-term care. In fact, I was struck this morning, I was in Jim Martin Schramm's, these aren't valuing statements on my part, but I was struck in Jim Martin Schramm's discussion this morning on immigration in the United States that by his numbers, about $13 billion a year are spent by the United States on economic aid in other countries. And if you recall from our discussion on Tuesday, we're spending about four times that amount today to keep people in nursing homes. And as we talked about, and as we will talk about some today, that number is going to grow. And so we clearly have lots of choices to make in terms of how we spend our resources. I'm also, I want to have this discussion today, and I have some population and social trends that I want to use as a backdrop for this discussion, and I'm hopeful, since we have a partially intergenerational crowd here, I'm hopeful that I can get some of you to participate in this discussion, because part of what all of this is about is understanding that things have changed dramatically over the course of this century. They've changed dramatically in terms of population numbers. But there are also some social changes that have occurred, which in most every respect we view as very, very positive, like, as I will get to in a few moments, the fact that the fertility rate has dropped from something quite a bit higher early in the century to something now about two. And yet that has the confluence of those social changes and those trends have some meaning for something like what kinds of choices we make with respect to an aging population. And as I'll try and argue, as with many social issues, whether it's immigration or homelessness or whatever, there are particular types of people affected when these kinds of changes occur in a population. Really, the two issues that I'd like you to think about as we go through some of these trends are two issues that are certainly on the minds of a lot of ethicists, a lot of politicians, and a lot of other people in this country and elsewhere with respect to how to deal with an aging population and a rapidly growing aging population. One of those issues is probably best characterized by Daniel Callahan, who's an ethicist at the Hastings Center. And he talks about the need for us to move from a biological or a chronological perspective on aging to a biographical perspective on aging. And from my vantage point, that's a really interesting way to think about it, because on one hand, it makes eminent sense. I've heard many people even here this week, and I certainly hear it regularly, someone saying, who may be 70, saying, I feel 40, or I'm more active than, you know, my kids who are in their 40s and that sort of thing. So when you think about it in those terms, a biographical view of aging makes a lot of sense, because you would presumably figure out some way to measure needs of people, and you would provide services or benefits to them when they met those standards, rather than using age 65, for example, as the point at which you get Medicare or something like that. The rather obvious problem associated with that, however, is that we've come to view a lot of things like Social Security and Medicare as entitlements that we plan our whole lives around. I mean, I'm still a relatively young man, and one of the first things my life insurance agent wants to know is how old I am, so that he can calculate when Social Security is going to kick in and when Medicare is going to kick in, so that I can plan the rest of my saving around that. And so when we talk about these issues about, say, a biographical perspective on aging, which makes a lot of sense, we have to understand that we're talking about changes that would take, even if we wanted to take that approach, will take many, many, many years to implement. You may recall that right now we're in the midst of what has been, was a hotly debated issue, and that is the raising of the age for receipt of Social Security from 65 to 67. I happen to be the person who will get there the year that it reaches 67 in the year 2027. But that's a big deal. I mean, that's a big move of 2 years. The flip side of that, however, and this is where I want us to hopefully have a chance to talk about some social justice issues, is that every time we make a move like that, to try and address issues of this global population or social issue, we're making choices that differentially affect certain kinds of people. So for example, right now, the average life expectancy for a white male is about 72 and a half years. The average life expectancy for a white female is about 76 or 77. The average life expectancy for an African-American male is 66. So already, most African-American men benefit very little from Social Security or Medicare, things that they have paid in throughout their lives. And so there really is not an equal distribution in terms of who puts in and who gets out for a whole lot of reasons, health and other reasons. And every time we do something even rather simple, like move a Social Security entry age up a couple of years, we're affecting real people in real ways in different terms than you and I might be affected. The other issue that underlies all of this that I hope you'll think about is that there's also a raging debate that perhaps some of you have been involved in over what are the limits, in moral terms, that we can depend on family to help us in some of these respects. And that's a great deal of what I wanted to present in these trends and numbers today, is are there limits in what we can expect from future generations in terms of helping us as we age? And we really need to explore that issue. Again, someone like Daniel Callahan would say that there are limits, that maybe 60, 80 years ago there weren't limits because the expectations in the end weren't all that great. But that today, because of a confluence of forces, the expectations may be quite huge. And we may have to place some limits on what our expectations for family members are with respect to helping older people. Let me, having said that, also just say real quickly, I hope that we can generate a dialogue here again with a somewhat intergenerational audience here. I think when we think about changes over the course of the 20th century, many of us in this room have experienced those changes, can share perhaps from your own life stories a little bit about how you see things differently and how even they impact you or you see them impacting other people. And I would encourage you to do that. I would appreciate that a great deal. I apologize for these overheads. They're a little bit dark, but we'll go with what we have. Let me just say what this is so that we're all clear, and then I'd like to get some of your observations about what you think these numbers suggest. What this is showing is the actual and projected population of the United States, age 65 and older, by sex. So if you start on the left-hand side, where it gets to be a little difficult to read down here, this is in 20-year increments from 1900, 1920, all the way up to 2060, and we're, of course, closest to the year 2000 right here. And we have it by male and female. And also within the brackets, the bottom dark is 65 to 74, the cross-hatched in the middle is 75 to 84, and the single-hatched at the top of each column is 85 and older. Now, on Tuesday, we talked about the fact that one of the things that most people know is that we have 33 million people over age 65 or older today, and that number, as this reflects, will approximately double by the middle of the 21st century. What do these data suggest to you in terms of what might be happening inside of those rather global numbers?
More old.
Okay, that's a really significant point. When I attach the phrase social justice to today's presentation, that's one of the things that we really need to understand, is that while the population 65 and older is going to double by 2050, which would be right between the 2040-2060 columns, the population 85 and older will increase six times, from 3 to 18 million. And that's a really important point for us to remember. So what that suggests is that about half the growth in the older population is going to be in the 85 plus population. That group, 85 and older, is the most rapidly growing and will be the most rapidly growing part of our whole population for the foreseeable future. Also within that, both in terms of the general population and the 85 plus population, the fastest growing segments within those groups are older people of color. So for example, right now, if you were to say, what's the fastest growing group of people over the age of 65, it actually happens to be American Indians. Now, their actual numbers are still quite small, but proportionally, it's a rapidly growing population. The fact that 85 and older is going to increase, I mean, one of the things that happens here in thinking through these issues is you say to yourself, well, we're already spending 30% of our federal budget on benefits to people over the age of 65. So if we double that population, then we're maybe spending 60% if we don't change something. We're spending something about a third of our healthcare resources on people over the age 65. But that's where it becomes important to begin to think through exactly what part of the population are we talking about, because the majority of those resources, relatively speaking, are going to people 85 and older. We talked about on Tuesday that 5% of the population 65 plus at any one time is in a nursing home. Actually, one in four people over the age of 85 are in a nursing home at any one time. So you can see if we're going to have a population growing that dramatically, there's probably no way in the world that we could even build nursing homes quick enough to keep them. So we've got to begin to make some choices about what we're going to do and how we're going to deal with this problem in a way that is fundamentally not only celebrating the fact that people are now living this long, and you have to remember that those are, even if someone gets to age 85 and becomes somewhat impaired or frail or whatever, they've had 20 years of a wonderful, healthy life that people just didn't have even 15 and 60 years ago. So we need to keep these things in perspective. What else do you see in these numbers?
The burden of support for this population is going to fall increasingly on the wage earning groups, which is going to seriously impact their future ability to realize the benefits and the good things that our generation has had in New York.
That's a very good point. The way, in academic terms, what people usually talk about is the dependency ratio, the number of people, say, over the age of 65 versus those in the labor force. And that number is changing dramatically. In 1900, one in 25 people was over the age of 65. Today, about one in eight is over the age of 65. And by 2050, about one in four will be over the age of 65. So you're exactly right. We're talking about something, again, as we tried to get into a little bit on Tuesday, that's not just about, you know, these are issues that we can talk about just when we get to be older ourselves, but these are issues that affect all of us. What about from for those of you that look at other kinds of issues from a social justice perspective, do these numbers suggest to you?
The insurance rates, everything to do with any kind of insurance is going to have to change.
I think you're exactly right. And that's where, in fact, it was funny, I overheard in the buffet line a couple of days ago somebody whom I would guess to be in their 50s or something like that, complaining about their insurance rating based on age when, in fact, they thought they were as healthy as any 30-year-old. And these sorts of things happen. And that's where a biographical standard would make a lot of sense. Again, when that person gets to be 65, she would probably be disappointed if Medicare wasn't there to help out. And so we need to think through those issues. But one of the things that we need to look at here, and it is becoming a growing issue, is that do you see any difference between the male and female bars as time goes on? Many people have begun to argue that issues associated with aging are the women's issue of the 21st century. And especially if you look at the top bars, so the single hatch, which is 85 and older, there will be about, among people 85 and older, there will be a ratio of about 5 women to 2 men in that group. So we're really talking about a set of issues that, and I'll go on to explain in a couple of future overheads, in a slightly different way. We're really talking about a set of issues here that, of course, will affect all of us as we age, but will have particular consequences for women because they have longer life expectancy and for a couple of other reasons that I will pursue. What are some of the other changes that come to your mind when you, not so much maybe when you look at numbers like this, but when you think about how things have changed in this country since the early part of the century, since you were born, and into the present stage that might affect you as an older person or a younger person, or might affect how we as a country begin to work through some of these issues.
And then the care for elderly.
Okay. For example?
When I was young, there were no such things as nursing homes.
Okay.
And you cared for your elderly in your own home. And also, when I was, we had a tremendous population in the mental institutions.
Mm-hmm.
Your senile dementia.
Right.
And now these people are in nursing homes or in other type of care facilities, and they're not in the mental institutions.
Exactly. And actually, that's been a big change in public policy, too, to take aging. People had come to use, as you're suggesting, mental institutions as de facto nursing homes, and we have changed that. What's one of the reasons that nursing homes have become a much bigger issue? Does anyone have a sense of what, say, the leading causes of death were 80 years ago?
Oh, tuberculosis and heart disease.
Okay, well, actually, the top two, I think heart disease was not too far down, but tuberculosis and pneumonia. And does anyone know what they are today?
Heart disease and cancer.
Exactly. And so what we've seen is a real change in terms of what it is when people become ill that the course of their illness will take and the course of their life will take from more acute kinds of conditions into more chronic conditions. What other kinds of things have changed?
Yeah. Well, I know one of the things that's changed is, I mean, probably in my lifetime, is the female working force.
Okay.
And that many families are dependent on both people working, and that really hinges on one of those people to be at home to care for the elderly.
Exactly. One of the other things that's changed that's related to that and related to your comment a little while ago is that if you go back and if I were to sort of build on these basic numbers and show some family living arrangement household kinds of numbers, one of the things that you find is that in the early part of the century, and certainly it didn't change overnight, so it remained largely true through the middle part of the century, there was a great deal of co-residence between older people and their children. While there is sometimes debate over why that occurred, I think most people agree that the reason for that was that there was an implicit agreement occurring there, and that by and large, the older person owned the farm, or controlled the business, or owned the home, and it made a lot of sense for people to share the home and for there to be an implicit or an explicit agreement that that farm or that business or that home would go to the child with whom they lived and who perhaps cared for them. And certainly today, with our geographical distribution among most of our families, that becomes an increasingly difficult sort of thing. Anything else come to mind? Yeah.
At that time, too, families were larger, and many times the older person was involved in the child care and the care of the home.
Right. Exactly. Let me move to the next overhead. In some ways, it's just a mirror image of the first one. But I want to make sure we're clear again to broaden out some of the numbers we talked a little bit about on Tuesday. But what this is estimates and projections of the community disabled and institutionalized populations age 65 and older, beginning in 1980 and going through 2060. So these are projections. The part of the projection that probably will be least accurate if we were to look back at this in 2060 is the top part of the columns, which is the single hatch, which stands for nursing home. The middle part is of cross-hatching, is activity of daily living impaired people living in the community. And for those that aren't familiar with that language, activities of daily living, which is the way your physicians sometimes, how we're all sometimes assessed by physicians, certainly upon entry into nursing homes, if you have a long-term care policy now, it says in there that the policy will kick in at two or three activity of daily living impairments. Those are things like, can you bathe yourself? Can you use the restroom on your own? Can you mobilize around inside your home effectively? Can you feed yourself? And then the bottom part, the black, what are known as instrumental activity of daily living impairments, are things, again, I mentioned this on Tuesday, but things like driving, can you pay your bills, things that you don't need to exist every day, but that might represent some step toward needing some kind of watchful eye in order to help you through. And what these numbers show is that, let me go back to the projections that will probably be least accurate if we look back, is the growth in the nursing home population, because that assumes essentially no change in current policy with respect to nursing homes. And I think most people would agree that there's no way that we can maintain our current policy with respect to how we pay for nursing homes and their costs, given the size of this population. So that what may actually happen is that already, if you look at this, you see that where the growth is going to occur is that by the middle part of the century, there will be in the neighborhood of 12 million people already represented by these crosshatches living in the community who have some severe functioning impairments that require virtually daily assistance. Sometimes it's called personal care assistance. So that if you assume that we aren't going to have all those nursing home beds available or any way to pay for them, actually that community IAD or community ADL group is going to be larger than represented on this overhead. What's one of the other things you notice in looking at this that's similar to what we saw on the previous overhead?
It's about the same percentage as on that 2060 as it was. Well, in other words, all those over 85 seem to be in nursing homes.
Well, clearly that's what the projection is based on. That right now, 1 in 4, and so that's part of the projection, that if we're going to have that many over the age of 85, many of them will be in nursing homes. But I think one of the other things that you notice, especially in the activity of daily living impaired community group there in the crosshatch in the middle, is that there will be far more women than men. Okay? So again, I think when we think about... Yes?
Is that going to be a valid statistic then? Because by that time, the stress on the women that are not going to work, if they continue going to work like they are, might even things up a bit.
Well, that's a very good point. I mean, certainly a lot of what has killed men in the past may start to kill women earlier now. But that may be counterbalanced by the belief, although no one sees any real elongation of the lifespan, in other words, the longest time period that anybody can live, which is believed to be about 110 right now, some believe that we're going to be able to continually push up life expectancy so that life expectancy, for example, for men and women would be for men in the high 70s and for women in the low to mid 80s. So those may actually counterbalance themselves a little bit. And it may not be effective in the middle of the next century to look at people 85 and older. It may be that there are now more people 95 and older, and we need to look at it in those terms. But that's a very good point, and that's where projections you need to view very carefully. My goal here is to make for us to at least think about what the implications might be. Any other comments about this impaired group? Okay. One of the things that we need to understand about aging and health and related policy in this country, and somebody raised this earlier, but I think it helps to look at it. Let me try and raise this. It helps to look at this. Is that one of the very positive social changes trends that has occurred in this country in the 20th century is that we've reduced the total fertility rate from about 5 if you combine the two lines. The top line is black females and the bottom line is white females. From about 5 at the turn of the century to about 2 or 2.1 now, which is a wonderful thing. It has very many positive implications, and you know, there may not have been many sessions here that didn't in some form address global population issues and the need to bring the numbers down. And certainly if we're to be an example of these sorts of things, this is a very positive thing. When you think about aging and some of the numbers that we've seen thus far, however, there may be some unfortunate side effects of this change. And that fact that we're spending over $100 billion a year, for example, on long-term care in this country in public and private funds, about 80% of long-term care is provided solely by family members, and as I'll argue in just a moment, not only is this a women's issue at the older end of the spectrum, but it's a women's issue in the middle part of the age spectrum as well, because of that 80%, so of 100% of long-term care being provided, 80% of that is being provided solely by family members, and about 80% of that is being provided solely by women, either spouses or adult daughters. So if you combine those two, we're really looking at between 60 and 65% of long-term care in this country is being provided by women without reimbursement. And for reasons like you brought up in terms of the workforce issues, those are problems that perhaps women are less able to accommodate in their, or the confluence of these issues creates a problem that they're less able to handle. So one of the things about a social trend like this, although it has many positive implications in many other different contexts, is that if we're relying on children implicitly in long-term, in terms of our long-term care policy for providing long-term care, then we would want to have more children around than less, because we know that the more children you have, the more you're going to have when you get old and might need them. Okay? So this is an example of something that we wouldn't want to change for a whole lot of other reasons, but it clearly creates problems for us. And I'm going to show you in about three overheads how this works out demographically in terms of our ability to be able to say, in demographic terms, who in particular is going to have some of these problems more than others. The other thing implied in here, which some of my colleagues sort of joke about in terms of my family, but some people have said that if you really, when you're in my generation, that if you really want to be sure that you have good long-term care, stay married to your wife, treat her well, have daughters, and treat them well. And I have two daughters, and so we're working on it. But it's those kinds of comments, although said in jest, that get you to think about what kinds of things we may want to do as individuals, as churches, something that I want to argue more about tomorrow, in terms of the role that churches and Christian people can play. But that also suggests that buried in this number, one of the negatives associated with having few children is that, by definition, you're going to have fewer daughters. And if it's in effect daughters that we're relying on, basically what happens is about 3 out of 4 informal care providers among adult children are daughters. And when sons do provide the care, they're doing things like pulling out their wallet and paying for things, whereas it's the daughter that tends to be providing the more hands-on, personal kinds of care. A recent study that was done of caregivers in the United States suggests that if you were to sample, as they did, a national sample of family caregivers of people with ADL impairments, so they have at least one ADL impairment, bathing, toileting, eating, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, that on average those people have been providing that extensive daily level of care for about 5 years. And probably there's not one of us in this room who doesn't know somebody who hasn't either been or is in that circumstance, and therefore you may be well aware about how difficult that can be.
I was going to ask you, mm-hmm. if there's, you know, like two working parents, how do they get the daughter involved in this? Are you saying that the daughter stays at home with the parent in their house and the husband works?
Well, that's certainly not what happens in every case. But among, for example, in the same study that I just referred to, 10% of those women in the same study completely quit their work in order to take care for one of their parents because they had no other choice.
Can I just add something? Yeah. There are a lot of businesses now, of course, if they keep their employees, there's so many downsides.
Yeah.
A lot of businesses are leaving, having care leave where you can care for someone.
Right.
And then come back and go back to work.
Well, the Family Leave Act from a couple of years ago mandates that people can have up to 12 weeks to care for a child or a sick family member, including someone who needs long-term care. But even that, most would argue in this context, is often insufficient because the care often takes a much longer period of time. In this study, about 10% entirely had to quit work, and about another 20%, so 30% in total were affected. But the additional 20% in some form made modifications in their work schedule, either to go from full-time to part-time or to dramatically change their schedule so that they could be at home when they needed to be home and those sorts of things. So it's certainly not the same for everybody.
But we're in a situation where sometimes people have few choices but to do those things. Actually, let me go back to this, a point I meant to make earlier, go back to this very first overhead. We mentioned on Tuesday that age-related policy in this country is a relatively haphazard affair, that the first major policy occurred here in 1935, and that was the implementation of the Social Security Act, which took a step toward taking responsibility for older people away from families by providing that old age security in terms of income. The next step occurred about here in 1964-65 with the implementation of the Medicare-Medicaid Act, or acts, which continued to take away some of that. But since that time, we've actually had, although not explicit, an implicit move toward relying more on family members. And I mentioned on Tuesday, for those of you that weren't here, we can actually go to subcommittee minutes and things like that from our federal Congress and read in their language where Congress people are talking about not wanting to support a particular bill that might, for example, benefit family caregivers of older people, because their assumption is that they would simply be paying for something that's already being done and that they would rather use the money elsewhere. But there are other kinds of implicit choices being made in policy that don't often get seen in this sort of a context. One of those is, some of you may recall in 1983, the implementation of what are usually referred to as DRGs, or diagnostically related groupings. If any of you have been in a hospital in the last decade, you know that when you go in, by and large, unless they can't diagnose if they can diagnose what you have, they'll tell you how long you're going to be there. Doesn't really have a whole lot to do with whether you're better at that point. But if you're in for an appendectomy or for angioplasty or whatever you're in for, the DRGs say how long the hospital will get paid to have you there. And they're going to get that amount of money. And of course, their incentive is to get you out sooner, certainly not any longer than the period of time they're getting paid for. Some refer to that as out quicker and sicker kind of thing. But one of the things that people have begun to look at with regard to DRGs is that has dramatically changed the impact on family members in terms of providing care to anybody who gets out quicker and sicker, but recognizing that many of those people who are getting out quicker and sicker are older people who require some ongoing sorts of care. So there, although people don't often think about that as a long-term care policy, it certainly is something that we need to consider and think about. And recognize that people are being impacted.
Before you take that off,
yeah.
I want to ask a question.
Uh-huh.
Last two columns over here.
This side?
Yeah. In relation to the column next to it, there's a diminution. This last column in relation to the one just next to it. What is that? What does that mean?
65-74
age. Oh, well, these people are the baby boomers getting older. So if you view the baby boomers as a lump going through, and their progeny as a lump going through, the people behind them are just going to be fewer in number.
What you're actually showing there is a diminution of the total population.
Well, no. The total population, it won't increase all that much by this point. Most people suggest it'll be a little over 300 million, around 325 million, that sort of thing.
And it'll stay stable, kind of?
Well, right now it's about 2060, I think, 2060, 2065. So it's certainly not going to grow at the rate that the older population is going to grow, which gets back at the point about dependency ratios and who's going to be available to provide resources and that sort of thing.
But I guess the point is that there's going to be fewer 65 to 74 year olds between 2040 and 2060.
Yes, yes, there will be that change.
There'll be more 85 plus.
Exactly.
And there's another side of that picture. We're going to have, because we have a population of babies being born and young children who are compromised, probably won't be in the workforce, that will need also care because of the crack babies,
that's right,
and alcohol dependency babies and those types of things.
That's a very good point. One of, I understand earlier in the summer, I don't know how long ago it was, somebody was here doing sessions on grandparenting, and certainly one of the big issues in grandparenting these days. And when we're done, if you'd like, I have some just other materials that I brought. These happen to be on grandparents raising their grandchildren. But this is a perfect example of something that's a very, very big issue. For example, in a city like I work in every day, I'm from Wayne State University in the heart of Detroit. Central City Detroit is 70% African American. Although I couldn't recite the numbers for you at the moment, the issue of African American grandmothers raising their grandchildren because the generation in between is crack addicted or has some other sort of problem is really a tremendous issue. In fact, such a tremendous issue that huge foundations like the Kellogg Foundation are beginning to put large sums of money into not so much trying to understand why the problem occurs. I think they assume for the moment that they'd rather work on the kids. But for example, we have a project where I work where a number of community organizations have gotten together to teach grandparents in the city how to be parents again to children that are vastly different in terms of their exposure to things, in terms of their experiences, in terms of their life experiences than the children that they previously raised. And these are women that in effect have been raising children all of their lives. We have some grandmothers in these support groups that are in their late 30s. They just finished raising their own children, and now sometimes, often, before all of their own children leave home, they're raising some of their own grandchildren. And certainly this is not specific to any one population, but it's a big, big problem that will exacerbate some of these other issues. Do you have a question?
No, I had a case on the airline. On the way up, there was a woman, at least 70 or more, and she had gone to get her grandchild, because she's going to have to raise it, mm-hmm. 1.5-year-old kid.
It's very, very difficult, and it's happening by the hundreds of thousands.
And she couldn't even manage the kid on the plane.
This is another social trend that you might not see even after I describe it as something directly related to what we're talking about. I happen to think that it is. But this is the actual and projected percentages of marriages begun in each year ending in divorce. So if you go down here, in 1920, about 15% of marriages begun in 1920 ended in divorce. And the projections are that about 50% of those begin in 1970 and beyond. This is a little upswing, but it'll come back down just a little bit. This is important for a couple of reasons, people argue. One is that the argument is that it's not just a legal bond that causes family members to care for each other at any point in life, to say nothing about providing long-term care or the kinds of care that might be needed when someone becomes frail later in life. So one concern about high divorce rates is that more people will be approaching older ages without spouses. And if spouses are the people that we're looking to first, with adult children being second, with government being third, to provide long-term care in this country, then high divorce rates are a bad thing. Now again, we could all come up with good arguments from what we know and our own experiences perhaps. We wouldn't. In some respects, we're unhappy with the high divorce rate. On the other hand, we're happy that everyone who needs a divorce can get one. And so that we certainly wouldn't want to say, you know, let's lower the divorce rate so that we can have more spouses to provide long-term care. On the other hand, it's something that we need to think about. The other issue that becomes an issue is what happens when divorce occurs. So when children are present, when a divorce occurs, who do the children usually go to live with even still? Okay, it used to be 100% basically with the mother. Now it's still relatively close to that. And one of the arguments that people are making is that will increasingly place older men at risk because they will approach old age without a spouse. They will also approach old age without the kinds of bonds with their children that might cause their children to provide the kind of care that they might have had those bonds been stronger because the marriage hadn't dissolved. Now, as with all of these sorts of things, let's not forget that many divorced men maintain outstanding relationships with their kids, and for them there would be no difference. But we also know many, many men who become almost virtually unattached from their children following a divorce. And the argument is that for long-term care, again, if we're relying on family members for much of long-term care in this country, that for both of those reasons, both the absence of a spouse and the lessening of a bond with children that might cause them to be willing to provide that care later in life, that we may have a problem. Another concern here that is more anecdotal at this point, but I think more and more will be known about, is the issue of people approaching older ages married, but that it's a second or third marriage of rather short duration that might not have the kinds of attachments associated with it that a lifelong marriage might have. Now again, there are always exceptions to these sorts of things, but when you think even about your own experiences, or talk to people who have provided care for a family member, particularly a spouse, a lot of times the language you hear is, well, you know, we spent our lives together, this is a part of my role as a wife or a husband, that sort of thing. But you don't necessarily hear the same language if people got married when they were 60 and he shows up sick when he's 65. That attachment may not be quite the same, and the felt obligation be quite the same in terms of providing that kind of care. So again, a social trend that we might want to change for some reasons, wouldn't want to change for other reasons, but certainly has an impact on aging. I'll just quickly put this overhead up here because the point was well made earlier, that also in here is increasing labor force participation, up to the point where now we're seeing about 60%, just shy of 60% of women in the full-time labor force. If I remember the numbers correctly, if you look at women between 45 and 54, the rate of labor force participation is about 70%. If you look at women between 55 and 64, the rate of labor force participation is about 50%. And of course, for many of those women, as the point was well made earlier, working is a necessity. And yet those are the ages at which, if they're going to be in a position to need to take care of a parent, for example, that they might be called on to do that.
Well, that's another thing that divorce has caused a lot, is some of these women didn't work before, where they had to go out and start working later in life, which means to get anything themselves, they're going to have to keep working.
Exactly. And these arguments can continue on in that light. I mean, a lot of work was done in the 1980s, for example, to show unequivocally that even in states where there are supposed to be a 50-split at divorce, women always get the short end of the stick economically. And so not only do you have the need to go into the workforce, but they go into the workforce with less resources than they would if they had been the male in that marriage, on average. So there are certainly a lot of problems associated with that. Now, just as a way to try and pull together some of these trends such that we could look at them not only as people perhaps interested in full-age policy, but I would argue even could look within our cities, within our environments. I'll explain the thing. It's rather complicated. It's the best way I could figure out to present it. But I would argue that we could even look at fairly defined geographic regions that surround our churches, or at least even use this as a way to look at our own churches and who do we have in our churches, and what kinds of help might we be able to provide them. So what I have here is for 1980, the year 2000, and the year 2020, four columns in each, white male, black male, white female, black female. Okay? So white male, black male, white female, black female. And if you, having hopefully made the argument that we're relying on families in large part for long-term care in this country, by putting together some of what I've presented up to this point, you can begin to see who's going to be in the greatest trouble with respect to the availability of long-term care resources. So if you look here, for example, among white males in 1980, and these are, by the way, people over the age of 85, okay, about 45% will be married and have at least one child, so they're going to be in relatively good shape. Just shy of 60%, another 15 or 12% will be married with no children, so they'll still have a principal care provider available to them. All the way up to over 90%, this block here is they're not married, but they have at least one child. So for white, in 1980, for white males over the age of 85, over 90% of them had at least one principal care provider available to them, either a spouse or an adult child. Only about 8% did not have. So in that sense, it's this top single hatching that becomes most important to look at. So if you look here, you can see that in 1980, about 15% of black men had neither a spouse nor an adult child, about 20% of white women, and about 22 or 3% of black females. And if you begin to look through here, you can see and make some guesstimates as to who might be at greatest risk. So for example, in a city like Detroit, where it's a 70% African-American population, I need to be very concerned about this group of people right here. What this is suggesting is that about 30% of black females over the age of 85 in 5 years will be without both a spouse and an adult child, suggesting that we need to focus on that group of people and figure out something to do with them. While there are certainly males, both black and white, that are in similar situations, you can see that there is a race difference, but then there's also a gender difference between these two and these two. Now you see this number decline here because they're more likely to be, in other words, what you see change here is that they're more likely to have a child here because the baby boomer kids are starting to become available to them. So if we had a 2040, this would start to elongate down a little bit. In 2060, it would all elongate down just a little bit more. So I throw this up there, even though it's a little bit complicated, to suggest that I think that these, by bringing together some of these numbers that on one hand may seem totally unrelated, but on another, by looking at them together, I think we can begin to see which groups of older people are going to be at greatest risk, and that there might be some value in terms of thinking through that and looking ahead a little bit. And again, I'll say that I think that we can do this at the level of a city or a geographic region or a county or even the area that our church covers, to begin to look at. Demographic data are available down to very fine levels surrounding your churches. So these are the kinds of things I think that, to the extent that people are concerned about aging and health and social justice issues, there are gender differences, there are race differences. And as we begin to explore how to address these issues, we need to recognize that those differences exist, but also that they're going to change over time. One of the problems we have in age-related policy in this country is that the policy that they established in 1965 doesn't work anymore today. The population is bigger and more costly than they expected when they implemented Medicare and Medicaid 30 years ago. And by just looking at these numbers, you can see that if we wanted to develop a policy specifically targeted to addressing the needs of older people over the age of 85 without a spouse and without children, that policy would work great in the year 2000, but by the year 2020, it would be less effective because more people would have a child available, and it would be nice to segue into a policy that might take account of that fact. I talked a little bit more than I anticipated, and we're running short of time. But I'd be happy to open up to discussion anything that concerns you, any questions that you have with respect to age-related policy or health-related issues that you have come to these last two sessions with that maybe we haven't gotten to?
It's what I was thinking in this. There's so many families that don't get along anymore. This is assuming that they have children, that the children are going to help them out.
Yeah.
And I don't think that's necessarily the case.
And you know, that's an excellent point. And I think that, again, this is another implicit policy kind of issue that affects us in real ways that we don't really think about. And that is, more and more we've been effective in getting discharge nurses at hospitals to ask questions like, do you have a family member nearby? Do you have a daughter that lives nearby? So that we've begun to convince people at the front lines of discharge, for example, in hospitals, that these are important questions to ask. And in fact, I happen to be involved in a project right now where we're looking at people who were in an acute care, in a hospital for an acute condition. They were transferred to a rehab hospital for a longer stay to do some therapy or whatever. And the best predictor of how long they're in the rehab hospital is whether they have a family member nearby. So so that part of what the social worker or the discharge nurse or whatever is taking into account at that point is whether there's someone nearby to help. Now, of course, they're not asking whether that person is working full-time or whether that person has, I mean, some people have taken your point and put it in almost the most horrific terms, and that you could have a situation where, you know, a daughter now older was abused as a child and now being asked to take care of her father, for example. Well, discharge nurses or social workers just aren't yet in a position to start asking, well, do you want to take care of them? You know, do you feel good about taking care of them? But maybe that's the next set of questions that we need to ask. Because certainly there could be a lot of deleterious consequences associated with putting people in bad situations.
Is there right now any money available for family members who take care of?
There are some
kids who take care of them.
There are some Medicare waiver programs, like in the state of Michigan. Medicare waiver programs are the state, usually the Office of Services to the Aging or the Public Health Unit, go to Medicare or Medicaid and say, with this chunk of money, we'd like to try this. And so on a waiver program, there are spot efforts to do that sort of thing. But one of the biggest concerns among policymakers, and this won't surprise any of you who fill out forms for virtually everything that you do, is they can't figure out how to make sure people spend the money on what they're supposed to spend it for.
In a way, to me, it seems similar to foster care for children. You know, those mm-hmm. children don't have parents or don't have anybody to take care of them, right. And they need that.
Right.
And so it seems a similar situation.
Right. Yeah, that's a problem that those things don't exist. But people are trying to come up with creative ways of resolving these problems, too. So I mentioned briefly the sort of implicit social contract earlier in this century where an adult child might live with a parent or something like that and take over ownership of the home or the farm or the business. So we're beginning to see some explicit negotiation in families. Not a lot, but explicit negotiation in families where maybe rather than the assets being split up among all children upon someone's death, that there's an agreement made such that if care is needed, Sally or Sam will accommodate that, and there are resources to do that, and here's how they'll benefit from doing that. And so people are beginning to try and think through what might be some possibilities in terms of negotiating on a sort of individualized basis some of those social contracts. And of course now there are also things like long-term care policies and things like that that even 5 years ago weren't very common, and thankfully in the last year or two they've become a little bit better in terms of what they have to offer.
And the insurance pool is going to be going up. So under those policies, which are very expensive now, the premiums can be reduced and become more attractive.
That's right.
And become more widely known.
Yeah. And some of those policies, as I'm sure you're aware, now you can get back a large part of money if you haven't used any of the benefits in the first 5 years and things like that. One of the problems that frequently comes up with those policies is you have to read them carefully because a lot of them, as I think I mentioned earlier, don't provide benefits until you have two or three activity of daily living impairments. And the error that some people make is assuming that this policy is going to kick in the day after they have a problem, when in fact a long period of time can go between having your first activity of daily living impairment to the time you have your second or your third when that policy would actually kick in. So it behooves you to look carefully at the policies, and although the earlier they kick in, the more expensive they are, at least that needs to be a part of the calculation.
They also really have only a 3-year span, too.
Of providing benefits.
Yeah. And so if you use a year and a half of up with home care, and if you need more other care, you only get a year or so
better. Sure.
That depends on your policy.
It would depend on the policy,
right.
But that's what
there's a wide range of policies.
A lot of them also have a spousal benefit. I mean, if a spouse dies, then you have to pay the policy.
That's right. And that's a positive thing, that there are now a range of choices. I mean, even 5 years ago, you didn't have quite the range of choices.